On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Goodness gracious, it is so good to be back in the Mansion Studios. Holy mackerel. I mean, some kind of good. Got home on Saturday evening, then we had a Prism chat yesterday, Sunday, Father's Day. Spent Father's Day working. I think that's an appropriate use of Father's Day. That's what fathers are supposed to do, right? Or so we're told. I hope all the dads out there and all the moms and all the kids had an otherwise wonderful day. Home for a spell, to say the least. I would say that present scheduling looks like this week, next week, and the week following are all nice and regular here in the home studio. What is rapidly becoming the Porn Studio Sauna. It's right muggy in here, as the case may be. Probably muggy where you are, too. But then again, we are rapidly approaching the first day of summer, are we not? Yeah. So anyway, we begin a new broadcast week. This, the 17th day of June 2013. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. You can also listen live in, via other platforms like TuneIn Radio and Stitcher Internet Radio. Podcast feed address is at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for this program. You can also get the podcast over at iTunes. Okay. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. And we will, a gentle reminder, as we must, it is not something of which I'm fond, but it's the only way to keep this thing going. We are, our conversation is brought to you by you. It is through the dogged and determined effort of the Horn family commune that we have maintained this dialogue for as long as we have, approaching near 10 years. And the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. With its new subscription function, which you are welcome to try out, thank you very much. We need this evening to raise $240 because we had some nice contributions come in over the weekend. Thank you very much. And if we can raise $240 this evening, we will be even with where we need to be right here, right now. At least I think, and my mathematics is always, you know, subject to challenge. But it is the beginning of a new week, and that means, well, that means something. That's right, that's right. It's Moran Monday on the Horn. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up. You will not believe your eyes. You will not believe your ears. Well, not so much your eyes, because this is radio after all. But right here, behind this thin, cybernetic veil of canvas, are right-wing Morans of all manner, and a few, but you never know, we sometimes even find ourselves displaying some Morans from other quarters besides the right wing. Never know how that's going to shake out. But Morans we have aplenty. Women are advised to hang on to their bags, men to their wallets, and both to their children, as the right-wing Morans can get a little grabby inside the tent. No one will be admitted after the first 5 minutes. Head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in Morans. You can't tell the Morans without a program, and this is the program that tells the Morans. You just can't tell them much. For only 5 cents per hour of programming, you will be exposed to some of the greatest moranity known to the known world, or for that matter, the known universe. Moran Monday on the Horn has begun. And where shall we begin it? Where? Where? Oh, do tell where. Yeah, that might be. Okay, how about this? How's about a statement? Well, no. He's rapidly climbing the Moran polls. A bit of a vacuum, I'm afraid, was left by the exodus of 1L Michelle Bachmann. Dear Jeebus. Michelle Bachmann being gone, we're kind of hurting for some stupid. But no, never fear. There are always Morans to step up and fill the vacuum of idiocy. And one of those big vacuum fillers, if we can call him that, is this cat by the name of E.W. Jackson, who is presently the right-wing Republican candidate for lieutenant governor in the Old Dominion, Virginia. Right? Now, if you are an ultra-right-wing lunatic, you're always going to be welcome on the program hosted by Brian Fisher of the American Family Association of Tupelo, Mississippi. The American Family Association having gotten its start under, what was his name? It all blows past after a while. The Reverend Donald Wildman, who opened his career by opining against Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, the Tasmanian Devil, and so forth. Right, yeah, that one. But the religion racket is the evangelical online religion racket is that's a big draw. Draws lots of money. And consequently, it's no surprise that they have enough money to burn a wet elephant, a sopping wet elephant, with $1 bills, no less. Or even hundreds, who knows. And they got themselves, as you know, this little old radio empire that can even be heard when you're out there. Let's see, how does Little Feet put it? I was out on the road late at one night, saw my pretty Alice in every headlight. Yeah. Or maybe it's Mick Jagger talking about how he was driving along listening to the gospel radio station. Yeah. Well, if you tune in, you're going to get Brian Fisher, the American Family Association. This is the guy who says that Jesus wants all the grizzly bears killed. Not kidding. This is not prayer meeting Wednesday, but you can't always keep your morans corralled until the middle of the week rolls around. So let's go to Brian Fisher and the lieutenant governating candidate E.W. Jackson of the old Virginia, the old Dominion, old Virginia, carry me back, right? Who doesn't like the fact that there are people out there who are talking about the really ignorant, stupid, boneheaded, hate-filled things that he says.
Well, Brian, it's a sad commentary on our media and culture today that anybody who expresses a biblical worldview is marginalized and, frankly, not to put too fine a point on it, persecuted for doing so.
Yeah, he's getting persecuted. In right-wing Republican world, getting criticized is the same thing as it's the same thing as what Nero did to the early Christians. You know, cram a sharpened pine tree right up their butts, dip them in pitch, and light them on fire in the Vatican gardens. It's the same thing. Pointing out that this goober is a hate-filled, misogynistic, homophobic freak is the same thing as feeding him to the lions, if that ever actually happened. Right. How about that, though? Anybody that expresses a biblical worldview is marginalized and, frankly, not to put too fine a point, persecuted for doing so. What do we mean, E-Dub? by biblical worldview. You mean a worldview in which, from time to time, the sun stands still in the sky, even though that implies that the sun revolves around the earth when we know pretty well that it doesn't? Is that your biblical worldview there, E-Dub? Or are you talking about how a biblical worldview as to how maybe pi is defined as three, just three, in the Book of Kings? Is that your biblical worldview there, E-Dub? So we've gotten into his sense of his persecution complex and personal paranoia, but it's not enough that he has one; he wants to share.
And I think that's a sad commentary. But look, it's an attack ultimately on every church-going, Bible-believing Christian out there who holds to a traditional worldview. And frankly, I think one of my roles is to champion their right to hold their views without being persecuted for it.
Well, there we go again. Anybody seen any Christians in the United States being hung up on a cross lately? Whipped in the public square? Compelled to worship a portrait of the emperor? Thrown in a big hole? Anything? No? Well, that's okay. E-Dub wants you to know that that's what's really happening to you. If some barista at a coffee bar delivers you your half-calf mocha latte with extra foam, and it's a degree cooler than what you might want, by golly, you're getting persecuted in the name of Jesus Christ. Yeah. Notice how in his first paragraph or whatever we want to, he calls it a biblical worldview. And then it becomes a traditional worldview. You ever notice that, I mean, there were pagans who had a tradition, and their worldview would therefore be a traditional worldview. Oh, wait a minute, wait. The only tradition in the world is the fundamentalist evangelical tradition. You know, the snake handling tradition, the strychnine swigging tradition, the floor rolling tradition, the tongue speaking tradition. Right. Got it. Yeah. And wait a minute.
I think Americans are tired of being told that holding to Judeo-Christian values somehow makes you an idiot.
Now everybody knows that Texas Betsy is our resident Jewish mother. But we have lots of other listeners who were raised in the Jewish faith. Who have wandered away from the Jewish faith, or have chosen to be secular, or you know, whatever your position is, it's okay. But can I just ask? Because I'm not. I just happen to be part of that cultural subsegment that appropriated your holy book and started reinterpreting it for ourselves. Even though we didn't have the first freaking idea how to do it, we just kind of make it up as we go along. See, when E-Dub talks about a Judeo-Christian value, he means a Christian value. He just throws Judeo on there as a sort of a flourish, the way a personal draw a swirl under their signature sometimes, right? But if you happen to be Jewish by heritage or Jewish by religion, do you take a little bit of umbrage at old E-Dub here and the rest of the for-profit evangelical religion industry types out there who keep glomming onto your heritage to bolster their own weird, weird, twisted, bizarre sense of antediluvian mythology? Just asking.
As you put it, makes you backwards, makes you ignorant, and unless you buy into the sort of contemporary morality of the day, you are a person to be shunned.
Now, okay. Sure, E-Dub. Why not? But he's about to go into one of those places that I'm kind of particular about. Yeah, you'll understand.
Be shunned. You know, our founding fathers.
Oh, here we go with the founding fathers. Strap in. Get the tennis ball and the duct tape out.
Believe that this should never be a religious test. And yet, that's what we're seeing today. We're seeing people applying a religious test to me, saying anything you believed or said as a minister disqualifies you from serving as lieutenant governor because you hold to these biblical views.
Now, hold on just a darn minute. Nobody has said any such thing. But being a pastor, this guy is natural. Well, lying comes naturally to him. Nobody said that being a minister means you can't be in government. We, the people of the United States, out there busting our butts to form that more perfect union, achieve domestic tranquility, and provide for the common defense, see Second Amendment, see well-regulated militia. We once had a Sunday school teacher for a president. And it didn't disqualify him from office. But people in this guy's party talk about that Sunday school teacher and spit on the ground at the mention of James Carter's name. Hypocrite much, E-Dub? Nobody is saying that anything he believed or said as a minister disqualifies him. It doesn't disqualify him. If the man wins the election, he will be the lieutenant governor of the Old Dominion. Virginia, carry me back. There won't be a single petition filed. There won't be a lawsuit filed. Nobody will say that because he will have been elected by something resembling, hopefully, the will of the people of the Old Dominion. What people are saying, however, is that it is fair to question whether or not an individual who has espoused as much hate in his adult lifetime as E.W. Jackson has espoused and taken unto his breast. Yeah, that's fair. Welcome, 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 E-Dub, or should I say Reverend E-Dub, or Pastor E-Dub, or Bishop E-Dub, or, I don't know, Noble Lumpkin E-Dub. Welcome to the American political process. If you don't like having your positions questioned, go back to the pulpit. Because the very nature of American evangelical so-called Christianity is that the sheeple sit in the pews and never question a word that the anointed one up there in the pulpit utters, even if he starts babbling in tongues and rolling on the floor. Well, look at that. He's been slain in the spirit. Son of a gun. Of course, the religious test business is a bit of a red herring because that's constitutional in nature. In other words, the federal government can't say, are you a Christian? Please. Yes, no. If no, please don't file for office. That's what that means. And they can't say, are you an Episcopal? Or are you a Presbyterian? Or are you a Catholic? Or are you a Jew? Or no. Can't do that. Unconstitutional. Pretty easy to get our heads around. But old E-Dub, he confuses people taking issue with his vast, vast storehouse of hatred with the federal government imposing it. And see, that's why I told you it would be real interesting when I mentioned, when he mentioned our founding fathers. Whoops, the baby. Yeah. A couple of thank yous going out there. Thanks to Sal and thanks to Kate, who got us started this evening. Thanks to them, we only need to raise $200 more this evening to draw even with fundraising. Thank you both very much. Mark writes in and says, "Ooh, a new toy on the horn site? You can't just go putting these new toys in front of us techies without us trying them out. Oh, do please." We need to know if the darn thing works. Just signed up for my monthly donation, and it worked. It will be nice that you can have some sort of minimum monthly to plan on. Glad you're back in the saddle. Well, I haven't been out of the saddle. And it's just that when I go to D.C., things get a little bit weird from time to time, and sometimes it's hard to get back to the barn and saddle up the horse and go riding, to extend the metaphor. So that's why I said earlier it should be a fairly regular schedule from now through the first week of July. Then I'm back to D.C., and, you know, we'll keep broadcasting there, too. And then a question. Just wondering, says Mark, no Netroots Nation this year? Nope, no Netroots Nation this year. No money. And more's the pity. But they also rejected our submission for a panel out there, apparently not being too terribly interested in hearing about the AICA Act or how it can go about protecting communities. And no interest. But no, it would have been nice. I badly wanted to get back out to California. I love going to California. So just to continue along, 21 minutes past the hour, and get back into the essence of Moran Monday, because there's a lot of them. You know, I mentioned in the little pitch that goes with the beginning of Moran Monday that there are all manner of them. You know, the mean ones, the hateful ones, and the ones that are just plain dumb. Well, we know that we need to go to Radio Rwanda for the just plain dumb part. You know, Fox News, Radio Rwanda, same. Greg Jarrett is one of their hosts there. And they trained their cameras on him and asked him to start talking about the Trayvon Martin trial. Well, let's just get right to it, shall we?
Look, one of the things we have learned in the last half an hour is that 4 o'clock today, the judge is going to knock off a bit early in the voir dire process of prospective jurors, and instead she's going to be holding this Fry hearing. It's named after a famous case, but it's basically a motion in limine from both sides in this case to present voice recognition.
Wait, you mean a Fry hearing isn't a hearing as to whether or not George Zimmerman should go and visit old Sparky down in Florida? Darn the luck. I guess I'm getting ahead of myself. Back to noted legal scholar Greg Jarrett.
Recognition experts to be able to tell the jurors in the case once the trial gets underway in earnest, whose voice that is on the 911 call. There's a scream that's being heard in the background. And, you know, one side says it's George Zimmerman, the other side says it's Trayvon Martin. And if a voice recognition expert can actually say who it is, that might speak volumes about who's attacking whom.
I mean, look, we've all worked with tape recordings, You know, tape recordings are funny because it's like you need the lyrics to the song so you can follow what's being said, that type of thing.
Yeah, because, you know, the Trayvon Martin trial, it's just like when you couldn't understand what... Jesus. Them little boys from Liverpool, I can't... And that Elvis, who the hell knows what he is singing about in that Hound Dog song? I can't understand a word he's saying.
But here, with a scream that's short, I mean, ostensibly, what, they're going to compare it to voice exemplars?
Right, exactly, that they have.
Yeah.
And also, even if he does allow it, both sides are going to have...
Somewhere, there are millions of Americans who are watching this, who are hanging on every word. I'd be running screaming into the yard if I... This is just voir dire. This is just the jury selection process. We haven't even gotten to the... Where were you on the night of stuff? No opening, and Radio Rwanda is already in sweat condition alpha.
Their own expert that's going to cancel
right.
Each other out.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, what you got to do is, as far as I'm concerned, is you got to look at who's got injuries consistent with screaming.
Right.
Well, no, the point he just made, sorry to interrupt you, is that it's always the objective.
the hell does that mean? Who's got injuries consistent with screaming? Is he implying that a dead guy can't scream? Because there's only one dead guy in this story. I have no idea.
The forensic stuff that's going to trump somebody saying, oh, that's Mr. X versus Mr. Y saying it. Let's look at what really happened.
Right? Let's look at what this judge has done. She has...
Okay, we're back to Greg Jarrett now. We're done with our panel of experts, at least for the moment. Remember, this is a Moran Monday story, so it's got to come to something.
He's tried to narrow the focus of evidence and restrict the evidence to just what happened that night, what you can see, what you can hear, the percipient witnesses, mm-hmm. the statements by the defense. Mm-hmm.
Now, as we wait for the other Moran shoe to drop here, a little reminder. This Jarrett genius is the same cat who, last week I think it was, argued that George Zimmerman has already been punished enough for the cold-blooded killing of a teenage boy because he, George Zimmerman, has put on 100 pounds in the county stir. Because in 21st century America, that's a fitting punishment for blowing away a 17-year-old African-American kid with some Skittles and tea. The court sentences you to put on 100 pounds in county jail. You will be released at pound 101.
Has said, we're not going to have any of this stuff introduced as evidence about the history of Trayvon Martin, whether he had a history of, you know, getting involved in fights, making
right.
threats, marijuana use,
being suspended.
Gun use, so yeah. on, being suspended from school,
right.
and so on and so forth. We're not going to judge the defendant or the
except
alleged
on the marijuana,
victim.
I think there may be evidence that there was marijuana,
there was marijuana
in his system.
Yes.
That may come in, maybe.
Right. It depends on...
But she left it open.
Yeah.
Right.
And
right.
You
yeah.
have the autopsy report.
Yeah.
Is there a toxicology
yes.
on this?
Yes, it says something.
What does it say?
Let me see if I can find it.
Well, while you look yeah. for that, let's talk about this a little bit.
Sure.
Because if...
Oh, do let's.
If an ME takes the witness stand, medical examiner, and says... He was high on marijuana based on toxicology.
That's a fact that this jury is entitled to know.
And how does that
play? Well, thank you, Your Honor.
Play.
Well, that's a very good question. How does it play?
If he is high, he may have acted irrationally
yeah,
and
he...
may have been violent.
Can somebody please, can somebody get a bong hit over to Greg Jarrett? Just pass the Dutchie to the fox hand side, okay? Let's see if he gets irrational and violent. Long time ago, and I think I've told this story before. Long time ago, I knew a fella in law enforcement. And I asked him, just as a matter of curiosity, I said, who would you rather arrest? The guy who's pounded down a couple of six packs of Milwaukee's Beast, or the guy who just got done smoking a couple of numbers? Cop looked at me and said, oh, I'd rather arrest the high guy any day of the week. I said, why? He said, because the guy with two six-packs of Milwaukee's Beast under his belt has got two six-packs of liquid courage in him, and Major, well, you don't understand. What's wrong with you? I haven't done anything. Well, the guy who smoked a couple of numbers will go, oh, okay, yeah, this really sucks. And he said, I don't even need the handcuffs. Now, this is beside the point of whether or not we ought to be arresting people for using cannabis. No. But what kind of bubble do Fox people live? If anything proves that the demographic for Fox News Radio Rwanda is like 80 and up, that moment, that Moran moment, does it. Jeebus. If he's high, he may have acted irrationally and may have been violent. Of course, there's the whole thing that Greg Jarrett doesn't want his octogenarian demographic to know, and that is that you can have cannabis in your system for up to a month after using same, and it doesn't mean that you're like, you know, dude, totally wasted. What did this guy do for show prep? Watch Reefer Madness? Mercy. It's too much. See, there it is. Waggy in the chat room. It's Reefer Madness! Kevin writing from Colorado Springs. Bob, you get the feeling these people discussing the Trayvon Martin killing are actually trying to convince themselves and their audience of George Zimmerman's innocence? Deep down inside, I believe they know Zimmerman's guilty and just can't bring themselves to admit it. Right. Right. And they know that, but then again, George Zimmerman's daddy has put out a book now that you can buy for $3.99 online. Let's look at some quotes from Florida v. Zimmerman uncovering the malicious prosecution of my son, George, by Robert Zimmerman Sr. There's a chapter that's called Who Are the True Racists? The implication being, you know, not little Georgie. George! No. In that chapter, Who Are the True Racists, Robert Zimmerman, Moran, yeah, this is an official nomination, Robert Zimmerman, Moran, lists organizations and people that he thinks are racist, including the Congressional Black Caucus, which he, white guy, refers to as, quote, a pathetic, self-serving group of racists advancing their purely racist agenda. All members of Congress, he says, should be ashamed of the Congressional Black Caucus, as should be their constituents. They are truly a disgrace to all Americans. That's John Lewis he's talking about. Really? John Lewis, beaten, threatened, marched side by side with Dr. King. That John Lewis of Georgia. John Lewis, truly a disgrace to all Americans. And then there's the NAACP, which he says, and again, this is a quote, it simply promotes racism and hatred for their own, primarily financial interests. And says, without prejudice and racial divide, the NAACP would simply cease to exist, which is probably true, seeing as how that racial divide and prejudice is why the NAACP came into being. You know, American apartheid. Robert Zimmerman doesn't much care for NAACP President Benjamin Jealous. He says, what I would expect of a racist. Then he says that the funeral director for Trayvon Martin's funeral is, quote, a racial activist and former head of the local NAACP. Referring to the attorneys for Trayvon Martin's family, Benjamin Crump, Natalie Jackson, and Daryl Parks, he calls them the scheme team. Oh, isn't Robert Zimmerman clever? The scheme team. Because remember, that was what the dream team is, what O.J.'s defense team was referred to. Yeah, right. He also thinks the National Basketball Players Association, really? Really, Mr. Zimmerman? Really? You went after the NBA Players Association as a racist organization? The Black Chamber of Commerce, racist. National Association of Black Law Enforcement Officers, racist. National Black United Fund, racist. United Negro College Fund, racist. Oh, Jeebus. And then this, because this is, after all, a Moran Monday nomination. He says that the FBI's investigation... No, really, sit down. Don't listen, it's Moran Monday. Don't ever put away the tennis ball and the duct tape. You're gonna need it, because otherwise you'll be hollering, and, you know, if you're in an apartment complex, people don't take kindly to it. So, because the FBI investigated whether or not the killing of Trayvon Martin was a violation of federal civil rights law, Robert Zimmerman Sr. says that the FBI lacked what he calls adequate resources to investigate clearly identified potential terrorists in the Boston area, and says that, tragically, we have suffered the consequences of Mr. Holder's politically motivated decisions. In other words, investigating whether or not Trayvon Martin's killing amounted to a 21st century lynching, well, that caused the Boston bombing. You know, if I was from Boston, or even Massachusetts, broadly, I think that would make me want to get, like, the whole freaking state together and go and knock on Mr. Zimmerman's door and you know, just tell him what an idiot he really, really, oh my God, really is. Your son blows away an unarmed teenager, and you use the slaughter of innocents by a pair of white terrorists to claim that the investigation of your son is racially motivated. You know, they're sick and they're sleazy in our culture, And we have it in abundance. But you have to work to get there. You have to really work to get there. And by the way, you know this is a small operation. It's very small. So I hope you will forgive me when I tell you that we have never copyrighted, trademarked, or patented the idea of Moran Monday. Toward the end of the week last week, Kim sent this along to me. And, I wanted to make sure, this is Kim in New York City. I asked for a reminder for today, just because I wanted to make sure this made Moran Monday. I really wish we had patented it or trademarked it, or, I don't know, had a watermark or something on Moran Monday, because we have been violated. This story comes from the Huffington Post's Nick Wing. It has to do with something going on in North Carolina. There have been a series of protests that take place on Monday in North Carolina that have been termed or tagged Moral Mondays. In Moral Monday, people from all over the state of North Carolina go to the state capitol at Raleigh and protest the ongoing, devolution of the idea of popular government in North Carolina. Clergy members are showing up. The state NAACP are showing up. Folks of all colors, all economic classes are showing up. Over the course of six demonstrations held since late April, 350 people have been arrested. 151 people were arrested just last week. Because there is a full-on assault on the idea of popular government in North Carolina via ALEC-influenced, a little something about ALEC in a minute, too. ALEC-influenced bills to impose voter IDs, fracking, taking not a scalpel or a knife, but a meat axe to education budgets, and, of course, also rejecting the Medicaid expansion under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Enter Senator Thom, T-H-O-M, they Tom, Goolsbee. Goolsbee. You know which letter goes after his name, right? Right. He wrote an op-ed in the Chatham Journal, C-H-A-T-H-A-M. I assume I do not pronounce the H in Chatham any more than I pronounce the H in Thom. This op-ed was posted June the 7th, in which Thom Goolsbee wrote, "The circus came to the state capitol this week, complete with clowns, a carnival barker, and sideshow. The Reverend Barber was decked out like a prelate of the Church of Rome." No insult is meant to Catholics. Love those little parentheses. Some of my best friends is Catholics. "Complete with stole and cassock. All he was missing was a mitre, and the ensemble would have been complete." Because, see, if you're a right-wing, ALEC-funded, about halfway to teabagging Republican in North Carolina, you can insult the clergy. It's only, remember old E-Dub from old Virginia there, just to the north of North Carolina? It's only persecution if it's happening to a right-wing religion industry evangelical. You know, like old E-Dub. But Thom Goolsbee, I'm a raggy Goolsbee. Freaking Scooby Snacks. Now, Thom Goolsbee feels free to refer to a pastor objecting to acts of the legislature which are wholeheartedly violative of the philosophy to which Reverend Barber adheres, Well, he can call him a clown. Or a carnival barker. Thom Goolsbee goes on in the Chatham Journal. Several hundred people, mostly white, angry, aged, former hippies. Hippie punching. Here it is. Several hundred people, mostly white, angry, aged, former hippies, appeared and screeched into microphones, talked about solidarity, and chanted diatribes. It was liberal theater at its best. Just like having a honey bun and double espresso for breakfast, the impact of it all left the participants jittery and empty in the end. Really? I didn't know a double espresso and honey bun would leave you empty in the end. I usually rely on milk and magnesia for that. Never short on audacity, the loony left actually named their gathering Moral Monday. Between the screaming, foot-stomping, and disjointed speeches, apparently representing Goosby has never been to a teabagging rally, or else he thinks that's actually good spelling, it appeared more like Moron Monday. Some bitch he done stole from us. The gathering was supposed to influence legislators. However, no one thought to bring out any Senate or House members from either party. The gathering was a field day for the Raleigh Press Corps, who came out in large numbers for the extravaganza in a carefully orchestrated parade. Yeah, because parades that aren't carefully orchestrated really don't often turn out to be parades, just sort of people milling around. Jesus, these people. In a carefully orchestrated parade, photographers and videographers walked backwards as Barber and his minions, that's right, Reverend Barber, his minions, strolled into an empty General Assembly building to voice more complaints and engage in several rounds of sing-along. Even more press showed up to document the standard bearers of liberalism, who were politely arrested by General Assembly police and escorted away well before session started. These brave souls can now claim hero status for all the courage they showed by standing up against the radical right. Because these, what were they? White, angry, aged, former hippies. Because they were protesting the fact that money's been taken away from the education of children. They were protesting the fact that food has been taken out of people's mouths. They were protesting the fact that they don't care to be poisoned where they live. Etc., etc., etc. And then setting up a straw man that he will then proceed to beat into oblivion. Representing Goosby says, where were the protesters when the Democrats were bankrupting North Carolina? Except for the fact that the Democrats didn't bankrupt North Carolina. See what I mean about straw man? Just 3 years ago, North Carolina was in a deep crisis. Wait a minute. I know. Math on the fly. Not my strong suit. 2010. Representing Goosby, it may come as a complete surprise to you, but the whole dang country was in a deep crisis back then. Would you like to have a conversation about how we got into that there crisis? About, oh, I don't know, spending our grandchildren's future? Because that's a phrase I'm sure you love to use when you're talking about that there Obamacare, right? Spending money we ain't got our grandchildren's future. Where were you back in the days before 2010, say 2004, 2003? Where were you representing Goosby when we were putting an entire illegal war on our grandchildren's credit card, huh? Where were you? Yeah, I thought so. All for it, weren't you?
Where were you when dim leader George Bush was out there smirking and smuggling and goofballing? Listen to that, Al Gore. He wants to put Social Security money in the lockbox. I want to give you money back to you. It's your money. And proceeded to drive our economy right into a ditch. Ditch my ass. Canyon. Representative Goosby was, of course, nowhere to be found. But back to what it... Just 3 years ago, North Carolina was in a deep crisis. The Treasury was empty with a multi-billion dollar deficit. The state health care plan was bankrupt. The state retirement plan was underfunded by hundreds of millions of dollars. A multi-billion dollar debt was owed to the federal government for money loaned to the state during the Great Recession for unemployment benefits. On top of everything, before getting roundly kicked out by the voters, actually the Democrats were roundly kicked out by Art Pope, representing Goosby. But then again, you probably take Art Pope's money, too, so you won't be mentioned in none of that now, will you? Mm-mm, no, sir. On top of everything, before getting roundly kicked out by the voters, Democrat leaders managed to raise North Carolina's taxes to the highest in the Southeast, barring every dollar possible. For over 140 years, Democrats had an almost total lock on power in Raleigh. That's why, among other things, North Carolina was able to pride itself on being the... Hi, we're North Carolina. Yes, we understand. We're below the Mason-Dixon line, but we're rather proud of the decent educational system we've got, and, well, doggone it, we've got a lot of the same problems that the our other sister southern states have, but we're working to correct them, and we like to think of ourselves as the rational southern state. That's why they were able to do that. It was not until the 2010 elections that the GOP had ever controlled both chambers in the General Assembly. And you know what happened then? Yeah, Alec. Even then, they had to contend with Democrat Governor Beverly Perdue, who fought every common sense reform brought forward, which means fought every drop dead stupid stump liquor swilling the piece of Alec inspired insanity. Right, you got it. Once ensconced in power, the pro growth common sense Republicans went to work like the business people they were, looting government. No, he didn't write that. Government waste was cut. Government was cut. A $1 billion tax cut was enacted, and the budget was balanced. The state's retirement plan was fully funded. Of course, he doesn't bother to tell you that fully funding that. Well, some people got ripped off, but you know they weren't those pro-business folks, so it didn't really matter. You might be wondering, what is the left complaining about? A better question is, what are they not complaining about? Apparently, even in the light of the overwhelming GOP election victories, brought to you by redistricting, they believe that the Republicans had no mandate to fix what the Democrats broke. That poor straw man's just getting hell beat out of him, ain't he? Somehow, the new leadership is supposed to print money on a magical press and spend our way into prosperity. No, you're not the federal government. You're not allowed to print money, representing Goolsby, but I'm sure you will be introducing a bad bill soon that bills can be paid to the state in specie, you know, of gold, silver. Yeah. Even Democrat pollsters. Notice how there's never any ick on the end of Democrat, Democratic? Mm-mm. He's still working from that whole Karl Rove playbook. Call them Democrats and emphasize the rat at the end, right? But he's one of these moderate teabaggers, because he ain't calling us Democrats, or those of us. Yeah. Even Democrat pollsters say these protests are hurting their party and its long-term plan to recover power. Regular people, i.e. voters, oh, goodness me, i.e. voters that I want to vote and not the voters I don't want voting, tend to shy away from the real radical fringe. Yeah, because you know how radical it is in America to want children to be educated and have meaningful services to the people who pay the taxes. Radical, I tells you. Radical. Nonetheless, the old hippies have found a new hobby and once again fallen in love with the sound of their own voices because, free speech, we don't want people doing that now, do we? They ain't good for business. Too bad they were not around to help when they were needed. Oh, Jesus God. Tom Goolsbee is a state senator practicing attorney. Well, I understand why he's practicing, because he's pretty sure with a brain like his, he ain't got it right yet. And law professor. Oh, dear God, where? He's chairman of the Senate Judiciary and Justice and Public Safety Committees. Run. What is it that Representative Goosby would like for people who have been dispossessed and disaffected by their jackbooted, roughshod running over of what had been a fairly at least a passing fair attempt at responsive government? What are people to do when they? Because this is petitioning for redress of grievances because they've got a grievance in it. Well, I want them to stay home and keep the damn heads down. We'll make them a nice state here one of these days after we done looting the place. Morons. The morons you have always with you. And that's just the beginning. Let's see. That's there. Oh, we got it. Well, here's a little game we're gonna play. Just gonna play it tonight. Who said that the National Security Agency scandal is an attempt, quote, an attempt to, quote, deliberately destroy the Constitution? Who said it? Who said that the NSA scandal reveals, quote, the elements of a police state? Who said that the NSA scandal represents a coup d'etat on the part of the Obama regime? Who referred to, quote, the totalitarian nature or the authoritarian nature of this administration? Who asked the question, the main question is, why is such a gigantic surveillance operation even necessary? What is really going on here? Who is the enemy? Just, who said it? I wish we had something to give away. But we don't. So, it's just a little game. Who said it? Maybe we'll get around to the answer later. But we do. We've got morons. Oh, plenty. To work through this evening. But this program is also, well, it's also something we call conversation radio. And I got to tell you, I am just tickled pink to be back in the chair here at the mansion. Because sometimes the magic works when we're on the road, and sometimes our rig just drives me halfway to distraction. With no apparent rhyme or reason behind it. And for the most part, knock wood, everything works here. Which means that, well, okay, there is a downside. You do not get to talk to Agnes when you ring the phone. And I know a lot of you really enjoy that. But at any rate, it's good to be back, and I'm looking forward to the calls. The number's 304-658-3333 on Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, and because I'm back here, they're both available to you whenever you choose to use them. Email comes into bobkincaid@gmail.com. At Bob Kincaid is the Twitter handle, and you can follow me on Facebook. Same thing, Bob Kincaid. Yeah. A pattern emerges. So we'll take a break. And when we come back, your calls, or more morans, or a combination of the two. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. Only $200 to raise this evening, and we're $60 into the process. PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So, too, is the traditional mail address, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, BECKLEYWV 25801. Checks, money, orders should be made payable to The Horn, not Bob Kincaid, because I don't get them. Boss Man Wayne goes to the mailbox, and he loves it when there's something in there besides an echo. So we'll be back. This is The Horn.
There was a woman in Georgia, didn't feel just right. She had fever all day and chills at night. Just a serious mind. In times like this, it takes a man and such style like you not often find. A doctor of the heart and a doctor of the mind. If you like a country with a boogie beat, he's a man to me.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Onward with the Moran, 7 minutes past the hour. Moran Monday on the horn. Okay, answer to our trivia question. And yes, Sparky in the chat room, one of our chat room moderator, and Sparky's also the moderator of the Horn Malloy Skype group, which is a whole lot of fun. I haven't been there in a while. I need to get back there. It's been way too long. Yeah, Sparky suggested, yes, of course, toasters. Toasters are more than appropriate. Toaster goes out to Jack in Shreveport for correctly identifying Rush Limbaugh as one of the quotes from the story, from the quotes that I listed there before the break. The main question is, why is such a gigantic surveillance operation even necessary? What is really going on here? Who is the enemy? The Tea Party, we know, is an enemy of the administration. We know that conservative Republicans, and I could give you names, are enemies of this administration. And then there's that blithering idiot Mark Levin with the voice made for print. If there's one human being out there who is more annoying to listen to on a radio than Alex Jones, it's Mark Levin.
Elements of a police state.
And yeah, it was crazy old cranky Ron Paul who said that the NSA thing is an attempt to destroy the deliberately destroy the Constitution. Isn't that comforting? Isn't that comforting? Yeah, that's imagine that. A Ron Paul voter. And, and lo and behold, the usual suspects are fulminating. I'll be damned. Hey, thanks, Jeremy. Much appreciated. $195 is all we lack now to meet the evening's fundraising goal. Thank you very kindly. Backing up just a little bit, Marty pointing out, Bob, according to Radio Rwanda today, Trayvon was the aggressor because, yes, yeah, because he had the marijuana. Yeah. No, we got lots of morons out there today. And I want to point this one out. It's another in the long litany of stories about what an absolute weasel Florida Governor Rick Scott is, you know, the unindicted co-conspirator. Right, that guy. But, and I tweeted this at Dr. John earlier today, just to make sure that I wasn't missing something here. This is a post from Think Progress. And this is, you know, this the content is not moran worthy. And I'm sure that the author of the post is not a moran. But it is moronic if you seek to be a reputable outlet for information regarding the right-wing assault on this country, and you just let stuff go out there when it doesn't make any sense at all. Now, I'm gonna read what I've got here to you from this Think Progress piece. And I'm not, no funny voices, no mockery, because I'd like to have a serious discussion about the state of journalism at some point tonight, whenever the mood strikes you, via email, Twitter, whatever. So this post is titled, headlined, Florida's Governor Signs Business-Backed Bill Banning Paid Sick Leave.
My, we do like our alliteration in our headlines, don't we? Florida's governor signs business-backed bill banning paid sick leave. Well, that sounds odious, doesn't it? It sounds odious primarily because it is. It's downright hateful. Let's take a run at that real quick. Paid sick leave. This here is, after all, Merca. And this here, Merca, is the greatest country in the world. Right? We are constantly reminded of that. Greatest country in the world. The only problem being that there are other significantly developed countries in which if one gets sick, the government guarantees that one may continue to receive some amount of financial remuneration during one's illness so that one does not lose everything because one became sick. Sounds downright humane, doesn't it? Yeah, we can't have that here in Merca, especially not in Florida. So here's the text. Florida Governor Rick Scott signed a bill on Friday that blocks local governments from implementing paid sick leave legislation, the Orlando Sentinel reports. He made his decision quickly, only taking 4 of the 15 days he legally had to review the bill before he signed it. In signing the bill, Scott sided with big... Now, I want to get this right. This is important. In signing the bill, Scott sided with big business interests, including Disney World, Darden Restaurants, owner of Olive Garden and Red Lobster, two places I will never visit again. What you do is your business, but I won't go there, seeing as how they don't favor people being able to... Well, I don't know. Yeah, so if you get it, so let's say you've got dengue fever or something, and while you're in the process of getting over it, or maybe it's bird flu or Smithfield meets swine flu, God knows what. But while you're getting over it, well, you know, your mortgage goes into default, they come and repossess your car, you know, because you're off work and unable to earn money. Well, hell, they're not contributing to the free market no more. I said I wasn't going to do any funny voices, but that applies to the text. I don't want to do business with people who think about their employees that way. Screw them, they're sick, they ain't doing us no good. In signing the bill, Scott sided with big business interests, including Disney World, Darden Restaurants, owner of Olive Garden and Red Lobster, and the Florida Chamber of Commerce. The bill is part of a national... Okay, this is where we have to pay attention. I must have read this sentence a dozen times before I tweeted the article over to Dr. John to try to get some, make sure that I hadn't just lost the ability of word knowing over the course. Right. So here's the sentence in question. The bill is part of a national effort to pass so-called preemption bills that would block paid sick leave legislation that is backed by the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, a right-wing group that coordinates conservative laws across states. Do I need to read that a second time? The bill is part of a national effort to pass so-called preemption bills that would block paid sick leave legislation that is backed by the American Legislative Exchange Council, a right-wing group that coordinates conservative laws across states. Is it just me, or does it make it sound like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, supports paid sick leave legislation? Because I know there is no way between heaven, hell, and Hollywood, Florida, that ALEC supports paid sick leave legislation. That is anathema to that crowd. But this sentence says that they do. On the one hand, I suppose you could say that I'm merely quibbling over a single sentence in a blog post. But darn it, if this information is being put out to inform people, then what happens when we're actually counter-informing them? And what I'm getting at now is the fact that, you know, I read Think Progress every day. Sometimes I agree with them, sometimes I don't. They have a feature on there that I have yet to figure out why it's on. It just beats me. But that's neither here nor there. What seems abundantly obvious to me is that they do not have an editor. A copy editor, a managing editor. They don't have an editor. And you know what? That's a bad thing. Just because stuff is moving over from the print world to the digital world does not mean that everything involved in print media was bad, superfluous, or unnecessary. Editors are necessary. Not just to keep cranky old grammar goons like me happy. It actually has something to do with credibility. And it has something to do with the value of the work. Now, the rest of the post is okay. It explains the bill has made moot a 2014 referendum in Orange County that would have decided whether to require paid sick leave. More than 50,000 voters had tried to get the measure on the November 6th ballot, but the county commission voted it off. It made it onto the ballot in 2014 thanks to a three-judge panel. So it's going to be on the ballot, but the legislature has mooted it out. Well, this is infuriating. It says a little something about the real value of voting as it is understood by the Republican right wing in this country. The only things worth voting on are whether or not, are how many Republicans are going to control the government. Because Republicans controlling government in a place like Florida is almost taken as a given. But you see this all over the place. It appears that there is a general there's this general failure that can be explained as best as I can tell as follows. Well, we have spell check and we have grammar check. Who needs an editor? Just as we're having a debate, a discussion, whatever, about how much value there is in playing a beautiful mind with the with the entirety of the digital communications of the people of the world, and of how much value that is, so too, this. We are reminded by a simple sentence like this, that there is no replacement. There is no computer or cybernetic replacement for having somebody look over copy. And I say this because, for instance, we're working on a couple of written documents on the 18th. And I spent a solid hour and a half today working with my dear colleague Bo Webb on a piece of copy. And making sure that it said what we wanted it to say. It goes beyond drafting. It is, in fact, editing. Isn't it interesting that this who needs an editor approach has taken hold in the blogosphere, on the one hand, where written material is concerned, and yet at the same time, we value most those pieces of citizen journalism that's done via video, in which someone has used a video editor to make sure that the video conveys as succinctly as possible the message that we seek to get out. Texas Betsy pointing out that Driftglass over at Professional Left has a whole running thing right now on how Glenn Greenwald is in desperate need of an editor, but he expands it to most of the blogosphere. And it is true of most of the blogosphere. I confess I can't get through a whole lot of what Mr. Greenwald writes simply because anytime anyone disagrees with him, it turns into a seventh grade slap fight, which is part of the reason that I have such a low opinion of Glenn Greenwald. But we're not going into that. I'm really trying hard to stay away from that. Editors, old jokes aside, the editing function is a vital one. It's not just about setting policy. It's about making sure that your particular publication maintains some standard of professional language usage, professional message conveyance. And I'm not talking about PR and all that don't think of an elephant stuff. I'm talking about simply communicating via the English language, in this particular instance, what it is that you're trying to communicate. And that sentence probably needed an editor, but this is all done live and it's on the fly. Jesus, if I pre-recorded this thing, I'd never get a show out. I'd be going back and editing until, because I do edit. Because I care about the message conveyed. So that's just out there for your consideration. And the underlying story is sickening. These United States of America, our union, democracy that it isn't and never has been, works people harder than any other developed country in the world. We have less vacation time. Paid sick leave is certainly the exception and not the rule. And the rest of the world looks on at us with a sort of shocked horror because, well, you know, damn it, this is the United States. This is the kind of thing we were actually set up to get right. Or at least we were in the post-Lochner era. And we are getting it patently wrong. From health care to retirement. Jesus. Paid sick because, you know, what? It's good? Because it's good? When people lose everything simply because they get sick? One of the things that this story points out is that there is more to the failure of this government and this country at present than simply health care. Okay, let's say you got health care but no paid sick leave. So you get sick and you're not going to go bankrupt. Maybe, because a lot of bankruptcies are occasioned among people who have health care but just can't do the copays. But let's assume a best case scenario in which one has health care, one gets sick, and one's health care needs are met. Well, you're still sick, and that means there ain't no money coming in. And that's groceries, and that's the power bill. And the water bill. Sick for a week? Yeah, you'll probably be okay financially. You'll still be in a hole, but maybe you can dig your way out in a year's time. Sick for a month? Sick for two? Fur freaking get it. This is America, where we pick ourselves up from our own bootstraps. and the rising tide lifts all boats. Yeah. It's a real problem. And it is a problem that other developed countries simply do not have, because they have chosen not to have that problem. This is a self-imposed problem. Or not self-imposed. Well, that's that whole convoluted discussion about whether, to what degree do we hold voters responsible for the people that they send to office, who then go there and proceed to screw them as hard, as fast, as deep, and as nasty as they possibly can. Let's go to the phones. 28 minutes past the hour, 304-658-3333, or Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jeremy, what's up, man?
This Trayvon thing drives me more and more nuts as it goes on. I'm sure that a lot of the Horn members have children probably my age, 30 and above. When we were teenagers, gangster rap was kind of a big thing. It still is. For the most part, it did to some degree glorify the lifestyle, but a lot of it, including the late great Tupac, kind of foreshadowed its evilness and the downfalls of living that lifestyle. He fell into the same trap that Mike Tyson did in some ways, whereas he was scapegoated and pushed down certain roads because of the money he was making doing what he was doing. At the same point, he showed a lot of compassion for women and his mother, even though he was tried for supposed rape, which he claimed was death, and he never did. Now, that being said, when I was in high school, kids would throw things around like gang signs, smoke pot, and for the most part, they turned out okay. I think people realized, for the most part, that music was more entertainment than real life. So that being said, the fact that Trayvon smoked pot, may have taken some pictures making some sort of gang sign like the West Coast sign, you cross your fingers or something stupid like that, should not reflect on his personal character. The funny thing about rap back in those days was people like Tupac admitted that 90% of their fans were white. They knew it. They weren't even their own race.
Well, listen, I mean, Jeremy, that's there's nothing new in that. The fact of the matter is, going back to the early origins of rock and roll, the market was driven by white folks. Even when the music itself was being referred to as race music. That's what they called it, you know, race music. Back when Little Richard was inventing rock and roll, which he did. Money comes through, it's an exercise of economic power. And yeah, white kids. But by the same token, what group is the single greatest recipient of welfare in this country?
I want to say white.
White folks. But who does the right wing demonize when they want to talk about welfare?
Welfare queens from Brooklyn who end up being white most of the time.
Yeah, but they're.
But they call them something else, and we know that.
Right, they demonize black folks.
I just love.
I gotta find this thing. I don't. Goodness gracious! I saw a story. I know what it was. I'm looking. I got it right here. Yeah, here it is. No, that's not it. Well, as soon as this thing. There it is. There it is. They had a panel, some right wing, the Faith and Freedom Coalition conferences, they had their conference and they had a minority outreach discussion. And, this past Friday, a guy named Rich Thompson, Jeremy, who runs an organization in Georgia called 100 Dads. That's a school choice organization, which is another way of saying, please can't we give religious schools public school money? He he gave a speech, and he said, I learned from a pastor probably over a decade ago. We had a candid conversation, and he said these three things. He said, there's only three things on this earth that defy logic. One is who's friends with who. Number two is who's related to who. And number three is who's paying who. So before we, and remember, this guy's from Georgia. So before we leave today, I would like each of us to contemplate when it comes to reaching out to diverse minority communities. Let's think about asking those three questions before we do anything further. If we speak to the latter, who's paying who, right now an extremely disproportionate number of people of color are being paid by the government. Therein lies a serious problem. We can't just cut everybody off instantaneously, but we have to have a serious conversation about how we get people to be producers and not receivers.
But even the concept of the government is paying you welfare, you cannot live on welfare. There is no frickin' way that you can live on welfare. At one point in the distant past, not too distant past, I was working for DHL. They went under. I was entitled to, I think it was, between $17 and $20 a week for welfare. That would not buy me food for the week. Well, it would, but if I was to buy like a 5-pound sack of rice and a bag of potatoes, maybe. But, I mean, you couldn't pay your bills on that.
No, hell no.
In the dark, you couldn't get gas. So this whole fallacy is just something they've made up, and just a screaming point. That's all it is.
And but the thing is, it also very nicely supports their inherent native racism and bigotry. And that's what it's about. It's not about underlying policy. It is about them self-justifying the fact that they are unreconstructed Confederates, Jeremy.
Right, and yes.
So, I mean, look, my son thinks he's a rapper, okay? And I'm not being critical, but and I'm not. I don't want to betray myself as a geezer, but you know, some hip hop speaks to me. The stuff that plays on the radio, no, because by the time it gets to for-profit radio, it's had all the meaning and all the value completely stripped out of it.
Radio doesn't speak to my generation. It doesn't speak to generations beyond my generation. It speaks to the current generation, but the stuff today, more than anything else, is commercial. It's pushed out there and pushed out there, like more and more slop. Some of the older guys that came out through the 70s and stuff, they got the idea of music and the idea of passing messages through their music. Their music was an art form.
Sure, I mean, I don't want to get all snooty and music critic-y or anything, but I can draw parallels between spoken word music backgrounded songs and the Iliad, for God's sakes. Okay? Because, you know, when Homer, if he really existed, recited the Iliad, he did it with a harp in his hand. Okay? No, I get that. But the commercialized stuff, not so much. No.
Yeah, the stuff that's been auto-tuned.
Well, right, and see, you just said the magic word. We have a rule when driving down the road listening to the radio in the car. If I hear one note of auto-tune, the channel changes.
And like and these guys in the past that I spoke of earlier didn't use auto-tune. Well, let me restate that. They changed their pitch by speeding up and slowing down their voice, but they didn't use auto-tune, and they did that to set the tone of what they were speaking about, usually. A lot of them did that. I mean, they could easily make it deep by slowing it way down, and that had a more of a dramatic effect to it, but the same could be said for a lot of things.
Amen. Amen. And so, you know, so all, and I guess to go back to the very beginning of our conversation, Jeremy, all this sort of loops back and ties together to show that, well, for instance, what they're doing with the Trayvon Martin trial over on Radio Rwanda is, again, not journalism, but rather self-justifying ex post facto self-justification for the bigotry and racism that already exists and is on display every day on that channel.
Right.
And see, you don't get to, Robert Zimmerman Sr. does not get to define who are and are not racists. Because the people who are in power don't get to. Just like Thom Goosby there. He doesn't get to define who's a hippie and not a hippie. You know, the fact that you disagree with the right-wing Republican assault on government in North Carolina does not automatically make you a hippie. Not that I think there's anything wrong with being called a hippie.
Neither do I. I agree with all their points.
Yeah. And frankly, there's a lot of stuff the hippies were right about. But, you know,
they spoke out of Vietnam, and look how wrong that was. We found out the Gulf of Tonkin was a bunch of bullshit right from the start.
There you go.
And that was our whole reason for being there. Although, you look at that incident, and then you look at that one, I think it was a three-day war we had with Israel, where they bombed one of our flagships and killed about 300 guys on it, and we kind of forgot.
Oh, you mean the USS Liberty?
Yeah, where they strafed it for 3 days? Yeah.
That was cold-blooded murder, but... And it was, and you know, that really was a conspiracy. That really was a cover-up.
Right, that really was an unprovoked attack, which we could have responded to, but we let it slide under the table for some reason. But we go after the brown people because of their resources again, and the fact that they were shifting their government system.
Right, exactly.
The main thing is I don't understand. I love how they can take all these little misconstrued facts about Trayvon's past, twist them, and try to paint him as this horrible, horrible person when it clearly looks like he scared the crap out of Zimmerman. He got the best of him. He didn't expect it, and his reaction was to shoot him.
Yeah, but understand this. The judge has ruled that they're not going to try Trayvon Martin in, they're not going to let the defense get away with trying the victim.
And so necessarily... We were against that idea.
Well, that's why Fox has moved into this mode. Because at the very least, they want to be able to say at the end of the trial, if in fact there's a guilty verdict, that it was all a frame job. And that's what they'll do. Because their demographic viewership demands it of them.
Right, and I won't call it any names, but I've heard people from our groups that want to try everyone regardless. They want all the information put out there, everything about Trayvon, everything about Zimmerman.
Well, anybody who says that doesn't have, I don't want to say that, that's too broad. But a trial is not the same thing as a fact-finding expedition. There are rules that have evolved over 500 or 600 or 700 years of the idea in Anglo-American jurisprudence of how to go about finding facts. I mean, the Monty Python skit about, you know, if she weighs the same as a duck, she's made of wood and therefore a witch. That's a broad parody, but it's also related to original ideas of justice. Trial by combat was an original idea of justice. If you're insulted, well, then we'll beat the shit out of each other, and whoever wins is the guy who was right. You know, might makes right.
Right.
And so, as a result, rules evolve over the centuries for how we're going to go, and there are determinations made. For instance, that the prejudicial effect of saying that Trayvon Martin was a pot smoker, whether he was or not, you know, I mean, there's such a thing as a contact high out there. The prejudicial effect of telling the jury that he smoked cannabis is greater than what is called the probative value of introducing that evidence. In other words, it does more harm than good and does not lead us to any sort of sound conclusion about whether or not what is alleged actually happened. You know, that's what's behind the hearsay rules. That's what's behind complaints about relevance. You know, if 3 weeks before his murder, Trayvon Martin had said, a dirty word. There is no probative value in that, but if you've got a bunch of evangelical church ladies on the jury, that's going to piss them off. So naturally, that's not going to be a part of the trial process. You understand?
Right.
And I'm not talking down when I say I understand. I'm just using a lot of the legal weasel words, and I just want to make sure that I haven't gone off in the weeds.
Well, no, it makes sense because, I mean, in legal weasel speak, Trayvon's defense team wanted to be able to handpick the jurors so that they wouldn't be biased, which probably meant they wanted to be white or close to what he is, which I believe is a mix of different races, but he looks white. That's probably what they're striving for. And the judge already said, no, we're not going to do that because that would take up to 3 weeks to pick out a jury of what you want. So that was one strike back. Another funny thing I want to bring up is the Goddess of Irony strikes into this case, too. When they mentioned that Trayvon smoked pot, we all know one of the major factors that got pot turned illegal in the 30s anyway. It was the fact that scientists and some doctors had said that pot made African-Americans extra strong and almost turned them into monsters.
Yeah.
So to say he was smoking pot kind of...
But, you know, I have to wonder... But it's not a risk worth taking in front of a jury, because it's going to be hard enough to get a jury in the first place. So that judge is going to be riding real close herd on what the jury gets to hear, because the last thing in the world you want out of this is a mistrial and then have to go through the whole tormented process all over again. But right. You know, I wonder, in 2013, Jeremy, is it really going to be... In 2013, are jurors going to sit there and think reefer madness when they hear, or are they going to go, oh, he's probably, oh, that explains the Skittles and the tea, add the cotton mouth and the munchies?
I would like to think that it would maybe explain the cotton mouth and the Skittles and the munchies, which again doesn't make you a violent person that you went and got Skittles and had Sprite. If I'd been in his shoes, and I mean Trayvon's shoes, I probably would have done the same damn thing. If I had some creepy white guy or African-American guy following me around the dark from street watching me, I would have confronted him too. Where I grew up, and I'm sure where you grew up, small towns, we had connecting backyards, and sometimes the safest way to travel was the backyards. Now, if you've seen any of the crime shoot photos from after what happened that same night, he was on a sidewalk in the backyard. He wasn't walking through backyards. The backyards had sidewalks that went through them because it was a community.
Right.
So I find that argument that he was crossing through people's backyards kind of null and void in that situation, too.
Well, let me just, and this is going to make me seem completely silly, perhaps, but, you know, I just got back from D.C. And our building is right there on Capitol Hill in the middle of the city. And I'm not really good at just sitting in the house all day. I have to just go outside, walk around, whatever. And so the other night, it was after showtime, I walked outside and was just standing there watching the traffic pass. And all of a sudden, this carload of white teenage boys drove down Constitution Avenue, and when they saw me standing in the driveway of the building where we are, they slowed down real slow. And you know what? I was scared.
And that doesn't surprise me. And
it turned out that they were little, I don't know what you call them, but... They then pulled into a little driveway a little further up next to our building and got out with their skateboards to come and skateboard on the terrace and the disabled access ramp of the Reserve Officers Association of America, which sits at the corner of First and Constitution.
Now, you're saying that, like I said, doesn't surprise me. Back after Columbine, this is reaching back a while, was it Columbine? Yes, Columbine. After Columbine, Chris Rock made a CD called Bigger and Blacker. In one of the skits, he says that if he gets on an elevator with white boys in it, he's going to jump the fuck off because he's scared of them. He made a joke about it, but it's true. if I'm walking down the street at night, even here in Little Old Vermont, and there's a group of anything that looks suspicious, I will cross the street, whether they're black, white, red, yellow, blue. I don't want to be on the same side of the street as they are and meet them head on, just because I don't know what the unknown factor is, and I don't want to experience a bad thing.
Yeah, this was, I mean, this was creepy. It really, because, well, I don't know. Skateboards can be weapons, right?
Well, it's not even a racist thing, but inherently built into everybody's DNA and genetic code, there is a fight or flight. And sometimes that fight or flight just tells you, get the hell out of the way. Just be cautious. It's that kind of that, you know, hair stands on end, that sixth sense kicks in, if you want to call it that. And sometimes it's good to listen to that regardless of who it is.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't mean you cower at every black guy or every Mexican you see, but it happens.
No, but see, that's the thing.
I try not to, but it does happen.
I don't know. Call me crazy, but I run across a lot of folks in D.C., and you know, I'm not going to sit here and say that I'm colorblind, but I just say, you know, I try to treat everybody with some dignity and some respect. But when a car full of teenage white kids slows down and just eyeballs the hell out of you, how many stories are there coming out of Florida of white privileged kids who go driving around looking for homeless people to stomp?
I've heard those stories. I got a quick story and a quick question for you.
Okay.
Number one, would you consider D.C. an inherently, actually two quick stories and a question. Would you consider D.C. an inherently dangerous city?
There are parts of it.
Okay, well, that confirms, because a while back I was in Virginia visiting a buddy, and we took a cab to D.C. And once we get to the city limits, the cabbie rolls the windows, walks the doors, and says, I talk to people from here on out. Because we're going through a rough part of town to get to where the bus stop was or what have you for Greyhound. Another story involves D.C. It's comical. It's two little, not real little, but I mean in terms of never really getting the big city country boys going to D.C. We took the the train in from, weirdly enough, Leesburg, Virginia, go figure. And we got into D.C., we got out, our friend was with us, same friend I took the cab home from his house to D.C., and we were walking in the mall in D.C., and this guy comes up to us with a canine hat on, after him, very gentleman, very nice, and he said, hey, you guys want to buy a map for me for the Smithsonian? And my friend looked at us and just walked away, didn't say anything. So it's a great book, it's only like, I think like $12. We bought it. And as we walked away, we got far enough away from the guy, my friend started laughing out loud, said, you guys just got had. What do you mean? We get inside, and there's like a 100-page color pamphlet with the Smithsonian for free.
Yeah.
The one we got was black and white and about the size of a Bible.
Yeah, that, and some of that's just, you know, praying, no offense, just praying on the roofs. I mean, it's the same thing as the old gag about, you know, the guy, wherever the story came from, that there were people out there selling the Brooklyn Bridge. Or swamp.
Well, I mean, looking back on it, we definitely can laugh at it, because we definitely got taken on that one, and it wasn't the worst outcome, but we definitely fell for it. And he said, chances are you're just paying for the guy's booze, because he did kind of in the end probably was a homeless guy who just put on a Smithsonian canine hat to look official. That's all it was.
Right.
So wide-eyed and, woo, the big city. We didn't even think anything of it.
Right, right.
But with that, I'll end my little speech for tonight and let someone else talk.
All right. Jeremy, you take care. Good to hear from you.
You too, thanks.
See you.
Bye.
Bye. Calling from Vermont, that's our buddy Jeremy. Thanks, by the way. Thanks going out to adding Rob to our list of folks helping out this evening. Thanks very much, Rob. He says we are now at 185 away from making our fundraising goal for the evening. Rob says, love Head On Radio. Thanks for putting on Dr. Bill O'Brien's show about the U.S. Constitution. Well, thank you for helping us be able to do that, Rob. And please know that helping Dr. Bill get the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution off the ground is a huge honor for us. And for anyone who hasn't listened to Dr. Bill's show, If you're not listening yet, you're missing something huge. Huge. And there is a podcast feed up now under his subdomain at whiterosesociety.org, and I heartily encourage you to start downloading the program. You know, it's interesting what Jeremy brought up as far as D.C. is concerned. In the midst of this whole national security, whatever it is, I actually found myself kind of glad that right there, close at hand, there was a Capitol police stand. And so when he saw that these kids were using the Reserve Officers Association of America as their personal skateboard playground, he suggested that they go elsewhere. You know, wasn't mean to him or anything. Just said, yeah, hey, you're not allowed to do that. Go on. Which they then did. But it was a little weird, you know, skateboarding at, skateboarding at 10 or 10:30 at night on Capitol Hill. Who knows? Who knows? But it was, and I hate to say it. It embarrasses me to say it about myself. It was a little bit unsettling. The other thing I got to thinking about D.C., you know, everybody talks about how nobody is from D.C. Well, there's plenty of people who are. But beyond that, something to ponder about D.C. If you want to try to look at the, if you try, yeah, because I like to turn the Rubik's Cube around a little bit and see if there's a different angle. And that's this. For years in the early part of this country, D.C. was referred to not as Washington, D.C., but as Washington City. And Washington City sat inside the District of Columbia. Obviously, Washington, D.C. has grown to include the entire district, and the areas out in Maryland and Virginia, and even West Virginia. There are parts of West Virginia that are a bedroom community to Washington, D.C. now. It's just a couple hours train ride. But I stood there one day looking at the city, and I thought, you know, this place was designed to be our national city. Of course, at the time that Washington, D.C. was created, California was only a dream, not even a dream. Most of the continent was still a dream. The Louisiana Purchase had not been affected. But it is. It is our national city. If you harbor any, for lack of a better word, romantic ideas, and by romantic, of course, you understand, I do not mean some sort of syrupy, smarmy love story. I mean romantic in its more dictionary definition sense. If you harbor any romantic notions of the United States, Washington, D.C. is our national city, and it is a place that we all, in our own way, if we're not from there, we have a calling, if possible, at some point to be there. It is where you go when you are aggrieved to petition the government for redress of grievances. It is a gigantic monument to national will, to our will to make the place that is the seat of our government, you know, of that more perfect union some of us are still working on, And it's good to remind ourselves of that sometimes. And I say all this because the right wing is very good at talking about what a shitty place Washington, D.C. is. I think back to George Wallace saying, "I'm going to send a message to Washington," and how every benighted political campaign season that we have involves somebody on one side or the other of the political divide saying, "Well, the problem is Washington." No. Maybe the problem is we the people. For Washington is only a reflection of the government that we create and we perpetuate. All the way right down to the National Security Administration scandal. Or, historically speaking, to the rather significant transformation of the country that took place after the Civil War. Washington City at one point in time was a city of mud lanes, very little in the way of human amenities at a time when other places like Philadelphia and New York or New Orleans were downright cultured. And I suppose there are in our country those who would like to see it be a city of mud lanes once more. There was a time when members of Congress elected to the same went for the sessions and slept in boarding houses, two congressmen to a bed. Now, coming up in a little over a month's time, Congress will bug out from Washington, D.C. for practically the entire month of August. That comes to us from a bygone era when you got out of Washington, D.C. in the summer lest you become very, very sick from malaria or yellow fever or any of the other noxious things that afflicted that ground. The very origins of Washington, D.C. and the ground upon which it sits were mired in a degree of political corruption. Because we wound up citing it there because somebody knew somebody who could get paid with what little bit of money the federal government had at the time. Maybe this doesn't make so much sense, but it's just one of those little gut check moments. The next time you hear somebody, and it will probably be a Republican or a teabagger or something, the next time you hear them talking about how Washington is the problem, I simply suggest that maybe you take a moment to consider that if Washington is the problem, then it is the people who get sent to Washington who make Washington the problem. Washington can also be a solution to a problem if, in fact, we treat it as such. Within the parameters of understanding that we have a certain form of government with which we work that ain't a democracy. It's something. But one of the things that it is not is a democracy. You can make an argument that it's not a meritocracy either. But it is, whatever else it is, a city for the whole nation. A monument to our will. And yeah, it can get tiresome and frustrating. But at the end of the day, it bolsters me a little bit to remember. To remember that we, the people of the United States, are trying to make a more perfect union, even if we're not doing it democratically. democracy is aspirational in this country, not operational. And I try so hard to get that across. Maybe I don't know. Maybe people just don't believe me. And I try to talk facts and not truths, because truths are fluid. But that, to me, is a truth. Democracy in the United States of America is aspirational and not operational. Thanks to Beth for knocking us down to 165. And thanks to Betsy for knocking us down to $115 to raise for the evening. It is deeply appreciated to be able to start a broadcast week and be close and not having to worry about digging out of holes. $115 keeps us out of a hole as we move toward the remainder of the program. It is More In Monday on the Horn. Your calls are welcome, 304-658-3333, or Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, on Skype. You know the email address, bobkincaid@gmail.com. Andy writing in, he says, subject line, the problem with Washington. Pretty simple. The problem with Washington, the excrement that we send there, is the problem when you only get 15 to 20% of registered voters, which may be less than 60% of the possible voting population participating in a district House of Representatives election, then you have a problem. The problem, the apathy, it's a disgrace. The citizenry doesn't participate to fix the problem. And again, I go back to say, Andy, and I agree with you, that there are concerted efforts to make sure that people don't participate. Things like, they're all the same, and I'm not saying you make these arguments, Andy, you don't. But whenever we hear somebody on either side of the divide say there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans, that is a meme that was promulgated by the right wing in this country to discourage people from participating. Another thought occurred to me while I was there, and I'm going right back to the phones in a minute. Another thing that Republicans like to say and right-wingers like to say is, well, the government's too big. And you'll recall that not too long before Katrina occurred, Grover Norquist, one of the most un-American human beings in this country today, famously announced that he wanted to make the government small enough to drown in a bathtub. And then we watched Katrina happen. That man's still not behind bars, and I don't know. Or at least the goddess of irony hasn't dealt swiftly and surely with him. But that's okay. She'll catch up. She's pretty busy. But no, they often say, the government's too big. You know what the problem is? And I have no compunction against saying this. The government is too small. Look at the biggest single factor in the NSA scandal has little to do with the revelations themselves and everything to do with where Edward Snowden came from. This is not a government employee. This is a guy who couldn't get through high school, couldn't get through college, couldn't get through the military, and somehow found himself at one point, he explained earlier today, making $200,000 a year working as a contractor, and $122,000 when he ultimately jumped. This was not some patriotic American working for we the people. This was somebody who was hired by a company that got its front feet in the trough at slopping time. And that is the story. You know, there's a hilarious, and I won't subject you to it, there's a hilarious short piece by Mark Twain called The Facts in the Great Beef Contract. And it centers on a contractor's attempt to get paid for beef he provided during the Civil War. you know, barrels of dried beef. In the early days of the Civil War, the government was desperate to have things like military uniforms for the Union Army. And they just about let anybody make them. And some of them got made on the quick and dirty, and they were great until it rained, and then the uniforms just fell apart. We hear story after story about the boys in Buttonut who were marching into battle with their feet bound in rags, but determined to fight for states' rights. We hear more about that than we do about the Union Army, but it was equally crappily provisioned. The Bush family first got its first little taste of wealth when one of the earlier members of that nasty family got his front feet in the trough at slopping time as part of the War Materiels Board of the United States during the First World War. The government is too small. We don't need any outside contractors doing so-called national security because a corporation has utterly no loyalties. None. A corporation is created and chartered and exists to make a profit. Witness Booz Allen Hamilton, which is now majority owned by, what family did I mention a minute ago? The Carlyle Group. And we wonder why these things are put in place. Interesting story in the New York Times about Mike McConnell, former director of national intelligence, who is now the pretty much near to being the head man of Booz Allen, who isn't returning calls right now, who has billed the federal government, you know, you, me, we the people, for ungodly horse-gagging amounts of money for building beautiful mind systems that can find spies hiding somewhere between page 12 of Highlights for Children and page 721 of the National Geographic. With maybe a cross-reference to the TV freaking guide, cybernetically speaking. The government is too small. You want to do national security? You need to be a government employee. When there are literally thousands upon tens of thousands of independent contractors out there, because that's the way Republicans like things. It's wealth transfer from us to them. We pay our taxes. The tax money goes to Washington. Washington takes the tax money and gives it to the Mike McConnells of the world, who then is so desperate for computer people that they hire high school, college, military dropouts who were a security guard, went to community college, couldn't finish that either, and wound up making $200 a year. The government is too small. There are what, 435 members of the House of Representatives? I'm gonna run all the way off the campus here and suggest that maybe we might have a more responsive government. We might have a government that was a little bit closer to having democracy be less aspirational than operational if we had a House of Representatives that numbered 970. Or a Senate that had 400 members instead of 100. Because a nation of 330 million people cannot realistically be represented by 435 individuals on one side of the legislature and by 100 on the other. It is patently anti-democratic. Having a Senate where the minority can require the majority to get 60% majority before a piece of legislation can pass is the very definition of undemocratic. government is not too big. The government is too small. And in fact, since I'm sitting here laying out some sort of political philosophy, I'll lay out one more. We talk about things that should happen in order to make the government more a matter, a function of the will of we the people. And we like to talk about things like election reform, campaign finance reform, both of which are very, very important. But at the same time we're talking about that, can we add one more thing? And the one more thing that I'm thinking about is this. Could we maybe start thinking about repealing the 22nd Amendment? Very few people recognize how odious that thing is. And I'm willing to gamble. I like a puncher's chance. I'm willing to gamble that current history will resemble former history in that the number of times that a president is elected more than twice will become as rare as it was before FDR. There's nothing to suggest that had he survived, Abraham Lincoln would have gotten a third term. FDR wanted a third term. I mean, not FDR. Teddy Roosevelt wanted a third term, but he screwed himself politically. We badly need to get rid of the 22nd Amendment because it is the 22nd Amendment that operates to make sure that second terms of presidents are largely ineffective, that has thrown us into political chaos for nearly two generations now. Just something to ponder, just something to think about. Would Barack Obama run for a third term if he could get one? Or if he was allowed to? Most presidents have decided that two was plenty and left voluntarily if they were not beaten after their first term. The only reason FDR runs for a third term is precisely because of the Second World War. And by his fourth term, I mean, look at the pictures of him at Potsdam. It is Potsdam, isn't it? Where he's sitting there with the blanket over him and is obviously sick and dying. And I don't say that because I want a third term of Barack Obama. I say that because I want a functioning presidency. And right now, and I don't care what president it is from Eisenhower forward, the second term has been rendered meaningless. Email coming in from Andy says, Mr. Bob, doesn't Booz Allen's Mike McConnell have a $5.6 billion DIA contract for 5 years? I think it's something like that, Andy, if that's not exactly the number. It's embarrassing. And the thing is, if we were doing this with properly vetted civil servants, the same thing we're paying Booz Allen, $5.6 billion, wouldn't come in anywhere near that because that $5.6 billion includes a profit! The profit motive, for God's sakes. And Andy says, yep, when you say Carlyle Group, you're talking Pappy Bush. It goes right to the bottom line of that wonderful old New England gang of confirmed Nazis, the Bush clan. Yep, it do. But, you know, we are afflicted with that sickness And it's everything from Washington's the problem to we need a smaller government. We are afflicted by that sickness that has been imposed upon us by the Republican Party that says, we need smaller government. When has an army ever gone into the field with its government saying, we need a smaller army? And it's funny, these goobers holler for a smaller government. By God, they never holler for a smaller military. Remember how they squealed like stuck pigs when the so-called peace dividend was kicking in? Mm-hmm. Why would you need a smaller government to deal with a bigger country? I mean, I sit there and I look at Washington, D.C., and I ask myself these questions. I look at the House and Senate office buildings. Cannon on the House side and Russell on the Senate side were built at the same time because the government had outgrown its capital. Then came Longworth and Dirksen. And then came Rayburn on the House side, and finally Hart on the Senate side. Do these and trust me, the office spaces are not magnificent. They're not huge. They don't have any lavish spaces for entertaining in them. They are, in point of fact, rather humble. Now, the older buildings, Russell and Cannon in particular, are elegant because they've got humongous tall doors and they're solid wood. But hell, Hart and Rayburn are, with the exception of the marble and stuff, practically Soviet in their grim banality. Does the right wing want to? No, because they like their office space. The right wing dearly adores its amenities in Washington, D.C. So do the teabaggers want us to maybe, the two oldest buildings are Russell and Cannon. Maybe we need to close those down and shove them and shove the people who are in those offices into the other two buildings. Smaller government! Yeah, go ask Marco Rubio how he'd feel about having a third of the office space that he has. Ask John Boehner. All of a sudden, that smaller government business go right out the window. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. 304-658-3333. I've been filibobstering too much. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
Hey, Bill. What's that?
I was just listening to what you said. Simon Cameron was Lincoln's first Secretary of War.
Oh, he was a thief.
Yeah, when you talked about the material... I believe that's where the word shoddy might have originated. Describing that material that fell apart in the rain in his uniforms.
Well, I'm going to look that up right now.
Yeah, check it out. I might have picked it up out of some author that was BSing out of his nose or something. And, he was so bad, Lincoln got even with him, no. He made him secretary. He made him ambassador to the Soviet Union. Boy, am I giving away. To Russia at St. Petersburg.
Yeah, to get him the hell out of the United States.
Get him the hell out of here as far as he could go. We didn't have a diplomatic relations with China probably in those days, or he would have
right.
Found a new tape. Well, he would have had...
And the etymology of shoddy, 1862, having a delusive appearance of high quality... from an earlier noun meaning wool made of woolen waste, old rags, etc., 1832, of uncertain origin.
But they mentioned 1862, and that's when they started calling them the uniforms and the powder he was providing, and the weaponry was Springfield made at the armory, and he was the guy was an example of a he delivered Pennsylvania to Lincoln.
Yeah.
And, you know, people don't realize how long this political corruption's been around. You wonder if any, how many people ever heard of Tammany Hall, for crying out loud?
Teapot Dome? Anybody?
Yeah.
Have a little teapot, short and stout?
The great line by Dick Gregory when he was running against, what's his name, in Chicago, you know, the boss man up there. In
Daley.
Daley, thank you. And he said something about, I think Gregory said something about the dead people vote late in Chicago or something along those lines. He was calling attention to the number of dead men. I don't know if you're familiar with the Harry Golden or not, the author from the 60s. Who,
no.
A Jewish guy from, he had a newspaper called the Carolina Israelite. And he wrote two books that were big sellers. One was Only in America, and the other was For 2 Cents Plain. And he talked about the word going out in June or July in New York City to the Bowery guy, start growing a beard. So you could vote once with a beard, once with a mustache, and once without, all under the names of people who were deceased. Yeah, so people think this is new.
Oh, yeah, and you know, that's interesting because I've got a story that broke earlier today about, let's see, what did they call it, that out-of-control Justice Department?
Yeah.
It turns out that there are something like 14, I'll see it here in a minute. There are... there were 7-Eleven franchises seized in New York and Virginia. And 10 New York franchises and 4 Virginia franchises were charged with conspiring to commit wire fraud, stealing identities, and harboring undocumented immigrants, according to federal prosecutor Loretta E. Lynch. I guess if your last name, well, never mind. But it turns out they were running what the government refers to as a modern-day plantation system, whereby they were forcing undocumented immigrants to work at 7-Eleven for 100 hours a week for pissant money, and then charging them out of their paychecks for room and board.
Oh man!
Now that's 2013.
See, what I've learned is if there's an angle to be played, somebody will play it.
Oh, and the reason I brought that up is this paragraph, Bill. Federal authorities told ABC News that at least 18 undocumented workers, reportedly from Pakistan, were given identities stolen from children and deceased persons and forced to work 100 hours a week while paying rent to their employers to live in boarding houses.
Yeah. Yeah, see, I hate to say things that are...
And you know why they did that, Bill?
What?
Because it's profitable.
Oh, yeah, well, sure. I mean, isn't that why people do everything? I mean, it's funny because... I remember I worked for an Indian or a Sikh who owned a bar, and twice he hires me, and we draw up a contract, and he calls me the day of the job and says, oh, no, I don't want you guys. And I turned down work because I had a contract with the guy. So finally, I said, look, he called me again. He said, I want you to play. I said, okay, I'll be happy to play for you, but I want a check in advance. So the guy sends me a check, and I go to cash it. And it's a hot check, Bob. Do you know what I mean? There was money in the account that he wrote it on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what he didn't know is the woman I was married to at the time ran the women's shelter, the Badger Women's Shelter in Lake County. And so we had a close one with the sheriff out there. And I call the sheriff, and he calls the guy, and he says, you wrote this guy a hot check. That's a third-degree felony. And so the guy wrote me a good check and sent it to me. I cashed it, but guess who never showed up to play? Me. I had learned by that time that you just, if you don't pay these people back in the same coin, but I think I've told you, my dad's brother was a ace pinball machine repairman, any kind of coin op stuff. They used to call him the man with the golden hands is what the fellas called him. And the fellas he worked for, Were the kind of fellas you saw in the movie The Goodfellas?
Yeah.
That's who he worked for, because my old man was part of
that little Benevolent and Protective Association?
Yes. Yeah. My dad was caught with a pound of reefer when I was 3 years old, which would have been 46. But the man he worked for, who was the head of the group. He set up the bribe. My uncle told me he took the money to the judge's house on Thanksgiving Day, and the bribe was paid, and there was no more trouble. So anybody who thinks this stuff is just happening, and it's our generation or one before us, well, the one before me, they ain't doing much of anything anymore. But to be honest with you, this has been going on. That's what when I listen to the professor, you know, I get the gist of the fact that, and because of the knowledge of Civil War. Yeah, you came up with that word shoddy, and I said, yep. And that was just the beginning. I mean, it was unbelievable how many guys actually built quality stuff. The guy on the Western Rivers, his name was E-A-D-S, Eads?
Yeah.
He built those river gunboats to kick the crap out of the Confederacy on the Western Rivers.
Right, with the Cumberland, the Mississippi, and the Tennessee and the Ohio.
Yeah, they could go up and down those rivers, and the rebels could shake their fist at them and maybe fire at them once in a while. And maybe they sunk one once in a while because they were...
Yeah, it was those boats that delivered the Union Army to a little place in West Tennessee that's referred to as Pittsburgh Landing.
Shiloh, yep. That's the old two-name system. I think Pittsburgh Landing is the way the South referred to the Battle of Shiloh.
Well, no, Pittsburgh Landing is...
Is where they landed.
It's where they got off.
Yeah.
Shiloh Church was... I mean, Shiloh wasn't even a community. It was just the name of a church.
The church, yeah, okay.
And that's... But it's interesting, a little geography fun moment. That's over on the Tennessee River in western Tennessee, Pittsburgh Landing. If you go east, there's another place on the Tennessee River that is South Pittsburgh, Tennessee.
Okay.
But interesting, one of my favorite cities in America, and up there in western Pennsylvania, it has an H on the end, P-I-T-T-S-B-U-R-G-H, whereas South Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh Landing are P-I-T-T-S-B-U-R-G.
Yeah. And Gettysburg is there. I don't know. Gettysburg, you're talking about, had an H on it at one time?
I don't know. Did it?
I don't think it did.
No.
I'm just guessing. But it's like Antietam and what's the southern name?
Sharpsburg.
I've been there twice and walked out territory a lot. And the eastern battlefields were places I have seen most of. I never got out west. You were a lot, I don't know, well, you were going to school in Alabama at one time, I know that, wasn't it?
Oh, in my early years, yeah.
Yeah.
It was almost to the level of ritual that in the spring, the eighth grade got to go to Shiloh. That's where you got taken for your eighth grade field trip. You got taken to Shiloh.
Yep.
You did the Memphis Zoo, and then you did Shiloh.
Yeah, well... That was the general I admire the most out of the Civil War is George Thomas, who was a man from Virginia who stayed with the old flag and the old army and kicked the crap out of Hood down in Tennessee.
Yep.
And everybody else, he was Sherman's chief, the guy who Sherman revolved around with the other two armies, the Army of the Tennessee and the Army
of the Cumberland?
The Mississippi. Thomas had the Army of the Cumberland. Union armies were mostly named after rivers.
Right.
Confederate armies after states.
The Grand Army of the Potomac?
Yep. Yeah, those guys. That's another guy. George Meade was handed command of the Army of the Potomac about 5 days before Gettysburg. He did a pretty fair job, all things considered, but it was his men who did the job. It was those rifle carriers who stood their ground and did whatever they were told to do. And hell, that was a Minnesota outfit that had something like 76% casualties, I think it was, maybe more, on the second day at Gettysburg. These guys were amazingly...
It's a fascinating place to see because it's a different kind of ground from most other Civil War battlefields. It's reminiscent. Well, there are a lot of things in Civil War history, and I don't know, maybe we lose some people talking about this stuff, but that's okay. There are a lot of things about the American Civil War that were prefatory or presaged things that we would learn in much more horrific fashion about later. Trench warfare.
18, yes.
But at Shiloh, there's kind of a warning about amphibious landings. because the slope up from the riverboat landing to the battlefield is almost straight up.
Yeah, it was a pretty hard.
It's almost like the cliffs at Omaha Beach.
Yeah.
Only not as high and not as rocky. It's just mud.
Well, I won't hang you up, but I'll leave you with the story I was talking to a buddy of ours about, who, you know, a guy who does music work and such. And I was reading Paul Brown's biography, and he brought up a point about one of the years, I think 42, and the team that was leading the pack, you know, the number one college team was Boston College, I believe. And they had to play a game on the last Saturday of the year against Holy Cross. And they planned a trip to a nightclub if they won the game. Well, they lost it. And so they didn't go to the nightclub. I'll give you the name of the nightclub and tell me what you think. They were on their way to the Coconut Grove.
I knew it.
Yeah. And you know what happened there.
Yeah.
That was probably... Was that the biggest nightclub fire in the country's history?
I think it was, yeah.
It makes that one that happened a few years back, although as bad as it was, it made it look like not much. In the amount of people that died in that Coconut Grove fire. I'll tell you, I got a kick out of Brown's... Brown, I was watching a show on television. They were rating coaches. They got down to 15, and they came back the next night, which I missed, but they had mentioned Paul's name. I'd have to rate Brown in the top 5 or 6, based on one lost records, as head coach of a team. I mean, those guys won the Eastern Division title. When they came in the NFL in 50, they won it all the way through 55. Plus, he won it 5 years in the All-America Conference. He was a straight-laced old dude. But in many ways, I met him twice, and interesting biography. But he mentioned that Coconut Grove incident, and I said, my God, what kind of luck did these guys have to lose their number one rating? But my God, they were still alive the next day. Sometimes life's ironies are enough to make you, let me go find a cave, Bob, you know, sit in it the rest of the few days I have left, because I'm an old fart myself, and today I had a big fight. I called the eye specialist because I had one of my so-called health aides rob me blind, no pun intended.
Yeah.
And one of the things I lost was a talking scale, which I like because I keep an eye on my weight, so to speak. And unfortunately, it was getting too easy. It was too much there. And so I asked the agency that works with me to, you know, and they said, well, get a letter from your doctor. So I call the eye doctor, and I'm talking to the young girl. She couldn't figure it out. She put on some woman that got into it with me so heavy. Finally, she said something. I said something about FDR. And she says, oh, you're one of those. And I said, what did you say? And she told me, I said, oh, I'm talking to a Republican. And she did not like that at all, but I got a chance to say it to somebody's face. And I've heard that term before. I hear that a lot, Bob.
Yeah, well, right, yeah.
Yeah, you hear it now and then, but I'll let you go. But, yeah, you start talking that Civil War stuff, and you talk about corruption. My God, it was... And he talked about Bush Sr. You know, he was in Dallas on November 23rd.
Yes, he was.
And there's been... I mean, the truth of the matter is, when you look at the people who dislike President Kennedy for whatever reasons... That's a laundry list.
Yeah, take a number.
Yeah, pick a number, and if I had that many enemies, which I probably do and don't know about it, who the hell knows how many you've really got. I mean, I hate to sound paranoid, but there are a few people who I imagine don't like me much, but that's the way things are, especially in the music business. If you got most of the work, they didn't like you much. But why did I get work? Because I had more dummies coming to hear me, I guess, you know. I guess there are more people with bad hearing that used to come to hear me. That's how that worked. Anyhow.
I don't know. I think you're damning yourself with faint praise, Bill.
Well, you have to know something about the 60s and the people that... I was lucky. James Cotton played a week in one club, and then he came back after a week for two more. And this poor guy couldn't turn around without falling over this short, fat white guy. You know, I was so full of questions for that man, and I remember Muddy Waters coming up and playing in the middle of the Well, what some people refer to as the ghetto. He was playing 110th in St. Clair, and it was outside. And there was a huge throng of people, and not a cross word that I hear exchanged between ethnic groups. You know, and that's what has kind of kept me going. I keep hoping, but what has really got tough is on ethnic groups, work has become tough. Because the factory workers, the entry-level job that paid a living wage, try and find them. And it's
oh, tough. Sure.
And I think that's why the you know there's a, so much animosity. Part of it is, well, I'm not telling you anything about employment. You know that more than me. You've got young children, and you know what do they do for school? And well, if they can still find some drinking water down there, number one, it wouldn't hurt either. You know, to be able to.
Well, that's the truth.
And as I said, this has been going on for centuries. They will. By the way, what do you think? Let me ask you while I got you. I've been meaning to ask you this. What do you feel about the people that founded the state of West Virginia? Was it 1863 they went out?
Hey, we're nice of you to mention it. We are 3 days away from our 150th birthday.
Okay.
June the 20th, 1863.
Okay, I wasn't sure when it was, but I thought it was 63.
I think there were legitimate reasons for the people who wanted to break away from old Virginia.
Yeah.
Because, frankly, this part of the state had nothing in common with the other part
of the
state.
You don't have one plantation, do you?
No. And the relative number of slaves kept in this state was certainly not worth fighting a civil war over.
Well, East Tennessee had that situation, too, with the... You know what the old joke?
Wait! Let me back up before I make myself out to be an ass over that. What I'm saying is, there were very few slaves in this state, and as such, there were not as many people who were willing to go and fight a war to maintain slavery.
Yeah, because there was nothing in it for them. Well, you know how you get the corn down from the side of a hill in East Tennessee or West Virginia?
How?
In jugs.
I should have seen that one coming.
Yeah, very old joke, but in some respects very true.
But it's interesting, that you would mention this, because there was actually a referendum on statehood, and very few people know that, Bill.
Oh, I didn't know that either. I thought it was leadership took them out.
No, there was a referendum as to which counties wished to remain in Virginia and which counties wished to be a new state. And that's why West Virginia has the very strange shape that it does down its eastern border, and why it has that eastern panhandle.
Okay.
That looks like the spout of a teapot.
Well, you guys, maybe you had fewer slaves, but they made up for it when the coal mines got rolling.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they made up with inhumane labor practices of a... It was supposed to be free until you went to the company store to pay for stuff.
Right. Wage slavery is another form of slavery.
Yeah.
Without...
Very true.
Without trying to in any way compare with the horrors of bond servitude.
And the problem that I have with some people is the ones that didn't recognize Joseph Stalin for what he was. That was the biggest gift the capitalists had in the post-war world, was the fact that this guy and Hitler could have formed a double play combination as far as their attitudes towards the rest of the world.
Yeah, instead of Tinkers to Evers to Chance, Hitler to Stalin to Mussolini?
Yeah, well, the guy...
You said double play combination.
The guy on first base can hold the ball. He doesn't drop it, which is real possible. Yeah, there are so many historic sequences that... it's like this Benghazi stuff. Benghazi. The first time I read about Benghazi was in the sixth grade when I was reading a book about a man who had the nickname the Desert Fox.
Erwin Rommel.
And I know it was pretty miserable to go into a graveyard and break up stones. But the way I feel about it, I didn't think you disturbed anybody much. Because I'm not a great believer in this. Once I die, I'm going to go to a better place. Hell, I've already been to better places than where I'm living now. So what? You know, what difference does it make? If I have to wait for that, I'll pass, thank you. Maybe I'll live long enough to see the world change in a positive direction, and I keep hoping, but I I'm a little pessimistic, Bob. What can I tell you?
Yeah, I understand, anyway, Bill. You come by it honest.
Well, yeah. Well, as I say, I was a rare kid, a white kid who grew up in a housing project and was in a minority in grade school for a while. And because you learn quickly about other people when you're around other people. If you live far away from other people and never talk to other people, you have no concept. And I think the playing blues and listening to New Orleans jazz and such brought me into musical contact with other people, and the rest of it follows. In the early days of playing blues in Cleveland, I was playing in bars in the middle of some of the toughest areas in the city, and never did anybody threaten me. That was more when I was working on the college campuses at Case Western. I'm right on the campus. Because these kids are coming from the burbs and think they could threaten me. They think the wrong guy.
Well, that's the same thing with me getting the queasy, seeing that carload of white kids slowing down and giving me the eyeball.
Because you never know what some people... I don't care who it is. Like one of my friends who had a little more pigmentation in his skin of a different type. We were someplace one time, and he was looking at a young crowd of people that look like him. He said, "Well, Bill, they'll have to rob you first, and that I'll get robbed if you don't have enough money on you." He was being straight up honest about a type of personality, which had nothing. I don't care if the guy was from Mars. You know, when somebody throws a gun in your face and wants your wallet, why do I care what he looks like or what nationality he is? It's the action that bothers you, not the fact that you see a guy who looks a certain way. I've seen it. We used to have a big festival. You were at the clinic a lot with your dad, and I imagine you must have eaten at some place up in what they call Little Italy.
Yep.
Because there was good, well, Mama Santa's, there was a place up there that everybody ate when I was a kid, pizzas and you name it. And they have a big feast every three or four-day feast in August connected with Catholicism. And the fellas that ran the gambling concessions up there, they were guys you didn't want to fool with. But the kids started raising hell with kids from other parts of the city that came up there to spend money. And these fellas that ran with the group, these older men, they had to take these kids aside and say, "Hey, what the hell do you guys think you're doing? The money that comes up here and is spent in this neighborhood during this feast, eventually a lot of it ends up in the neighborhood." And these old timers had to warn these kids. And these old timers were men you didn't play with. Because my uncle, they say, he worked for a lot of them. And they were straight up. The one guy got my old man out of what could have been a long time in the slam for a pound of reefer. In those days, in the mid-40s or late-40s, nowadays, and it's the old story. Anybody who thinks bribery and corruption is a new part of our society, better have a talk with Dr. Bill. He'll straighten him out in a few minutes.
I got no doubt.
Either. Anyway, I'll let you go. Take care of yourself.
All right, we'll see you, Bill.
Good night.
Take care. Bye. Bill, Mr. Stress, calling from Cleveland. I love... I get a lot. I never think for an instant that I don't get a ton out of these conversations. They're profoundly... They've made me into a different person. Going back to the email a couple of hours or so back, just want to make sure that we get these in. My little reflection on the absence of editing on the interweb tubes. Texas Betsy mentioned what Driftglass has done. And Beth wrote in, subject line, "Raw story needs an editor too. This story stayed up for 2 days before it was corrected. The subject is an Ohio bill that requires doctors to disclose personal financial information to patients. Raw story misread the Cleveland Plain Dealer story." I was reminded of this because Bill's in Cleveland. "Raw story misread the Cleveland Plain Dealer story and reported that patients would have to disclose personal information to the doctor." In other words, bass ackwards. The comment thread was an uproar over a non-story, as few people bothered to click on the original story. Those of us who pointed out the error were ignored for about 2 days. The story now carries this disclaimer at the bottom. Editor's note, like there is one. B. The original version of this article stated that women would have to disclose their income to abortion providers rather than the other way around. Raw Story regrets the error. And this, regarding paid sick leave here in the greatest country in America. Robert writes in from Australia. Bob, in Australia, if you're working full-time or part-time, you are entitled to at least 4 weeks paid annual leave, 5 weeks for certain shift workers, 10 days paid personal carer's leave per year, used to be known as sick leave or sick days, or as we say, a sickie, 2 days unpaid carer's leave when needed, 2 days paid compassionate leave when needed, and 12 months unpaid parental leave, plus extra entitlements for some employees. On public holidays, employees who would usually be working that day are entitled to a day off with pay. If you're employed under an award or agreement, you may be entitled to more leave, but you can't get less than the national employment standards. So, just a quick check here. Robert, is Australia sinking beneath the waves of no good moochers who have turned the social safety net into a hammock? Because the last I checked, some of the most expensive property on the planet was to be had in and around Sydney. And that doesn't sound like a place in economic chaos. It's actually a problem in the opposite direction. But don't worry, and I'm sure Robert knows this as well or better than anybody else in our Australia contingent. There's always somebody out there going after anything that benefits anyone but the rich. I noticed, what was it, a kerfuffle of over the last week or so. Didn't an Australian broadcaster get sacked for alleging that Julia Gillard's partner is gay because he's a hairdresser? Did I get that right? Yeah, the American right-wing radio sickness. Well, it translates. Indeed. Jim writing in, he says, under the subject line, DC jobs, I was appointed, vetted, and top-level security clearance on merit with strict competition. OPM, SecDef, nobody gave me a job as a contractor. All appointees should undergo the same depending upon job, including all members of Congress especially. You wonder about that. What is it about getting elected that makes you entitled to a security clearance? Or... oh, I don't know. Maybe do you have to go through something special to sit on the House or Senate Intelligence Committee? I don't know. Maybe that's part of, I don't know. But I like the idea of government. I do. I admit it. I don't like war, but I don't think our military should be run by independent contractors as a tax dodge. And I don't think we would have half the problems. Because remember, Mike McConnell came from Booz Allen to be George W. Bush's chief spook, and then left and went back to Booz Allen. While he was being a spook for George W., everything that we are objecting to in terms of domestic spying and data mining and what have you, was dreamed up not in the halls of Congress and not in the offices of government per se, but in the fetid profiteering minds of outside contractors, like Booz Allen Hamilton owned, as previously noted, in a majority sense, by the Carlyle Group. And you do, I trust, remember the Carlyle Group. Back to the phones as we round out this More In Monday. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
What's happening, Jim?
Well, I mean, it's a hell of a note when you've got a contract employee having as much access as this other guy and some of the stuff that goes on there.
And remember, not just a contract employee, but a contract employee who has risen to that level of security clearance, who's a high school dropout, college dropout, community college dropout, and military washout.
I don't know what's happened since I was there, but any of those things would have knocked you right out of being a janitor in the NSA. Now, I understand.
But again, he wasn't worth. That's the thing. He could never have gotten a job in the NSA, the CIA, the DIA. He could never have gotten a job within government.
But, you know, they're supposed to have security clearances on those employees, whether they're civil service or contract. That's what amazed me. I couldn't believe it. And the NSA now at Fort Meade has, what, 18,000 employees, and now they are building another huge complex in the Midwest. Did you know that?
I heard it, the thing I read says it's in Utah.
Well, you know, in another part of the country away from Fort Meade.
Yeah, and it is huge, and it's supposed to come online in the fall of this year.
Right. So, I mean, you know, I don't know who is the person who adjudicates the clearances for these people or whatever, but...
Well, I would you like an answer to that question?
Well, probably nobody.
No. If you get a top secret clearance and you're a contractor for Booz Allen, you've been vetted by somebody who already has a top secret clearance at Booz Allen.
Well, that's kind of like having a fox in the hen house, isn't it?
To say the very least.
I mean, those background checks are just incredible because, as I said on this program before, when they finish, it takes a year and a half to adjudicate a top secret with special access clearance. And by the time they adjudicate that, they have to restart the whole process again to ascertain any changes in your financial background or whatever that may have changed or anything in you that may have changed. In other words, when you're in that kind of job, and it can be pretty very stressful and nerve-wracking to know that people are going back to your hometown and talking to your teachers and people are in your hometown are calling you saying, why are these people coming to talk to me about you? I mean, that can be pretty stressful.
Yeah.
But it's necessary. And, you know, I agree with you totally as far as the government thing is concerned. They need it. But, you know, the trouble is Washington has become, you know, no wealth is generated there. And the only wealth that's generated there is the awarding of huge Army contracts or defense contracts or different types of contracts in the civilian sector and the non-military sector. I mean, Washington has become the milch cow for all of these people who tell you when they make their bids that they can do it for a lower amount of money. And when they go through the contract process, and I've been a contracting officer's representative, and I can tell you this right and the other, it is cheaper by 200% to have regular civil service employees than to go to these contractors that are there to rob, lie, cheat, steal, and betray.
Their way to profit. Because remember, that's the answer to the final Jeopardy question at the end of the day, Jim. What is profit? You know, well, these defense contractors operate for this reason. What is profit, Alex?
Well, it's not loyalty, and it's not for the security of the country. It's
no. I mean, consider that contract that Andy brought up, $5.6 million over 5 years. That works out to a little more, about $1.12 billion a year. And there's no way that the same thing could not be done by the government at vastly lower amounts of money.
At least 50%, and these employees would be protected under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And I'm going to let you go.
All right. You take care, Jim.
Out here.
Bye now. Time to roll out of here. This has been a dandy as far as I'm concerned. I hope you enjoyed it as much as did I. We will close this evening $115 short of what we needed to raise for the evening. Thank you to everybody who responded, because it's a lot better to be $115 in the hole than to be $260 in the hole. So thank you very, very much. And back for Titanic Tuesday tomorrow. Thanks to everybody, you first, who make all of this happen. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia, recovering from a nasty bout of flu. Hope you're feeling better, John. Thanks to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACACT.org. Go to ACACT.org and learn how you can become a part of ending Appalachia's agony. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
That's 25 years.